Hi, everybody. My name is Shelley Evans, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. That's the hardest part for me. I'd like to thank the committee for even considering me to be up here today. Dick called me when I lived in Cincinnati and asked me if I would be willing to do this, and I said, you know I'm coming back to Omaha. And he said, yeah, but we'd like for you to speak anyway. But where do you want to say you're from? And I said, Omaha, Nebraska. I've waited 9 years to say that, so I am so grateful to be here. And not just visiting. I don't have to cry now when I get done. Because I cried every time I left here. I'll probably cry now because I'm back. I'm really grateful to be here. I think it's always special where you find Al-Anon. And of course, I told the people in Milwaukee how special you were, and they weren't real happy to hear about it. And then I told the people in Cincinnati how special you were in different ways. I kind of learned my lesson the first time. I qualify for Al-Anon from birth. The only requirement for membership in Al-Anon is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. And both of my grandfathers were alcoholic, ex-husband, and a lot of you know John. So I qualify for Al-Anon. I'm the oldest of six kids, and I'm fortunate enough that I get to speak here today that my mom and dad are here. And I came from a really good home, so I don't know why I'm attracted to people that never are where they say they're going to be. Because my first memory was kindergarten, and I didn't want to go. I didn't see the need to go. At the time, I thought homeschooling was probably a good idea, but they said I needed to go. And my dad, a little background, my dad was a police officer for over 30 years, and my mom stayed home and took care of us. And my dad was working nights or evenings, so he got to take me to kindergarten, and I did not want to go. And he had to carry me in, and I was holding on, you know, crying, Daddy, please don't leave me. Maybe he won't leave me. And he put me down and he said, I'll be waiting right here for you when you get out. Now keep in mind, I live like half a block from school, across the street and up we go in about 10 houses. And I came out and there he was. And he taught me how to cross the street and how to get home. Like I said, why am I attracted to people who never are where they say they're going to be? It was drilled into my head from a very early age that you always let people know where you're going to be. You know, if you're going to be late, you call. If you're not going to be there, you know. But the people that never, I mean, alcoholics are exciting to me. I think part of it is because they do fun and crazy things. And when they're doing fun and crazy things, I don't have to. And I can watch and I can kind of live, you know, get that little jolt of excitement by watching. But I never have to fear that I'm going to get hurt. But you also don't have much fun. And people, after a while, don't want to just hear everything that happens. That's what I would do. I would be the designated driver for everyone. I learned how to drive on a Volkswagen bus, so I could drive just about anything. And I, too, one of the speakers was talking about being lucky enough to be on the fringe of the popular group. And I was on. I found the people that were exciting and fun. And, you know, the funny thing is, growing up, nobody ever knew my name. But they would say, oh, you hang around with so-and-so, and that was enough for me. They didn't need to know my name. They didn't need to know anything about me. It was just enough that they knew that I hung around with these other people. You know, I was trying not to think too much about what I was going to say, because most of the time I never know what's going to come out. But I was thinking about when I was younger and some of the really unrealistic, weird fears that I had when I was little. And, of course, I never told anybody, and I think that was coming attractions, that I'd have all these weird thoughts and feelings, but, boy, I wasn't going to tell anybody. And not only did I have the kindergarten thing about not wanting to go, when I was 7 years old, I saw a movie, and it was called A Touch of Spring. And this little boy's hair turned green. And they never said in the movie why. But I figured if it could happen to him, it could happen to me. And I never asked my mom or dad, is my hair going to turn green? I just assumed maybe one day I was going to wake up and my hair is going to be green. And so, I don't know how long, but for quite a few days, I would jump up in the morning and I would run to the mirror and I would check to see, because I never knew, you know, if it could happen to me. So I had a lot of unrealistic fears that I never thought to share with anybody. I remember one time we were driving around downtown, and my dad was, I can't remember if he was helping his bum or get out of the street because he knew him, or if he was, pointing him out. And I thought, that man is going to follow us home, and he's going to climb through my parents' window, and I'm going to be up there. You know, I mean, it's just like, and I never told anybody these crazy thoughts that were going through my head. And I'd have so many of them that I didn't hold on to the same one for very long. It was just like, as I kind of grew, you know, different things would just kind of take the place of whatever the fear du jour was that day. So when I was growing up, like I said, I'm the oldest of six, three boys, three girls. And like I said, I probably didn't realize what a great home life I had until I had kids of my own. I knew that there was we always had enough food and enough clothes to wear, but it was never the kind of food I wanted or the kind of clothes I wanted. And today I can see, being a parent and being somewhat mature through the 12 steps, what a gift I had. But back then I didn't really appreciate too much of anything. So the first boyfriend I had, the guys were interested in my friends. They weren't that interested in me, but I did keep track of everybody so that I could always let people know who was dating who. You know, so somebody, Rick, was saying about there's something about being needed. And so I figured out the best ways to be needed. And my first real boyfriend, he was really exciting. What happened to him, and this is the clincher, he wasn't too much different from anybody else, except for he kind of limped. And when I found out why he limped, he was running from the police through a graveyard. And he shattered his kneecap, and his buddy carried him home, and he had to have reconstructive surgery on his knee. And I thought, well, you know, that's my kind of excitement. And when you talk about, we talk about an Al-Anon settling for crumbs, and what our dating was for this, with this young man, was he would come over to my parents' house and I'd feed him. And then he would go out and do his partying. Now, I was so naive, I didn't know that. I just thought, you know, he would come over. So I didn't go out, like, to movies and to dances and do things, because he didn't have a driver's license, he didn't have a car, and he didn't have a job. But I could feed him. And so, but I was manipulative enough that when it came time to go to, like, homecoming or prom, then I would get rid of him and pick somebody who I knew had a job and a driver's license and kind of let him know I was available. And then I would just pick the guy that I wanted and get him to take me there. And then as soon as the event was over, then I, you know, kind of moved on. So I said my dad was a police officer. And my friends used to tease me that he would check up on the people that I dated. And I never believed him. I said my dad wouldn't do that. Well, I met this young man. My dad told me, never marry anybody you meet in a bar. And I said, okay, but he forgot to tell me about the keggers. And so I went to a kegger, and there was a young man there, and he had heard that you could bite a glass and chew it up real fine and swallow it and you wouldn't get hurt. So I'm standing there with my purse. I'm the only, probably the only person there doing this, with my purse and my car keys, just in case he needs a ride to the hospital. And, you know, everybody else is cheering him on, and I'm like, oh, you know, what's the closest hospital? Where are we? You know, how do I get him there quick? And thank goodness that was not the young man they had picked out for me. I did have some standards. I didn't like glass chewers. But this young man, you know, I don't know if I took him hostage or he took me hostage. I don't know. But we met, and something clicked. And his alcoholism was like Miracle Grow to all those things, you know, the need me, you know, the needing to be taken care of. And we had a lot of fun. I said I didn't date much, we didn't go places. Well, we went to dances, we went to movies, we went a lot of different places. We went to truck and tractor pulls, cage wrestling matches, things like that. And I went just because he wanted me to go. And he went just because I wanted him to go. And so after a while, you know, we were seeing each other every night for 3 months. So, you know, what's the next thing? You know, you get engaged. And there was something inside of me that said, you really don't want to do this. I was 19 years old. Nobody had ever asked me to marry him before. It's probably a good thing. But he asked me to marry him. And my dad said, there's some few things you might want to know about this young man. And he had found out that he had a record, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but the situation was, he had described it to me, and he was just very misunderstood. He had had too much to drink and was going to find his girlfriend, and he crashed his car, and somebody stopped to help him, and he beat him up. And he was just trying to find his girlfriend, and he just needed some help. And, you know, I could see my parents trying to tell me that this was maybe not the best match for me. And they could see the more they talked, the more determined that I was that this was going to happen. And so I went ahead. And also his mother said to me, "We were real worried about him until you came along. But since you've been around, he has improved so much." And I thought, "What? I've got to marry him. What is this poor man going to do without me?" Later on, I found out. But at the time, I figured he really needed me. And so I look back on that, and, you know, as the time came closer and the wedding dresses are bought and the, you know, the invitations are out, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't want to do this. This is not a good thing. But also, it was real important how things looked. And how would it look if I called this off with, you know, I mean, I would look really stupid and it would look really bad, so I just went ahead with it. I can remember thinking this was not the smartest thing that I've ever done, but I had this ability to take all those fears, and I thought, as soon as we get married, it's going to be okay. And I just pushed all that down inside. Shortly after we got married, about all my cousins were the same age, so these wedding invitations start coming in, and I'm real excited. You know, I'm a newlywed, and I'm telling him, okay, we have a wedding this day, this day, this day, and he says, I'm not going to any weddings. Will you like to dance? No, I don't. I just did it because you did. And right then, I knew I was in big trouble. But I also thought, you made your bed, now you lie in it. To the best of your ability, you just make the best of it. And so I tried to make the best of it. There were a lot of crazy things. You know, I'm living with active alcoholism, and I don't have a clue about what it is or how to deal with it. And so I'm 20 years old, and Friday nights, I would get physically sick to my stomach because I didn't know where he was going to be, when he was going to be home, and everything, of course, revolved around him. It was all about him. There wasn't slowly what the disease of alcoholism did for me. I slowly gave whatever was there away. And so Friday night, I'd be at work, and people would be saying, so Friday night, what are we going to be doing? And I'd be going, Friday night, I knew what I was going to be doing. I was becoming so isolated that what I would be doing would be standing by the window, peeking out through the Venetian blinds or drapes or whatever until he came home. Sometimes, you know, I'm not going to go into everything because you all have lived it, but I became very ill in a very short period of time. I wasn't eating. I wasn't taking care of myself. The only time I ever went to the grocery store was so that there would be food for him. It never occurred to me that I could eat if he wasn't sharing a meal with me. That's one of the first things Al-Anon taught me. Eat and sleep. You know, whether he's there or not. I mean, I had to be told how to act because I had slowly given that away. I had become so isolated. I had one friend. My family was getting very worried about me because it was like I had to be in my house. And I know today that I had to be there because then I thought I could control whatever was going on. If I was there, I could somehow stop it. I could somehow head him off. I could somehow, you know, do something to make this better. You know, this is not, we're newlyweds and he's never there and it's sometimes gone all weekend. And so one night I was going to show him what it was like to come home and not have me there. So I made my plan. It was Friday night and I thought, you know, I'm going to leave and I'm not going to come back until 9 o'clock in the morning. And so I left, and I came home at 9, and he came home at 10. He didn't even know I'd been gone. I mean, that's just the way it was. So I had one friend, and she was my sister-in-law, and so we were married to brothers, and so we would compare. We would commiserate together. And most of the time when I got off the phone, I thought, man, am I grateful I don't have him. So we kind of fed on each other, and it made me grateful for what I had, even though what I had was really sick, and I didn't realize it. And I'm so glad I didn't realize who I was and all the work I would have to do until today. That reminds me. I came to my first, this will give you a little idea of what it was like for me when I first started Al-Anon. Well, let me tell you this first. Okay, so for 3 years we're living this roller coaster ride, and I never know when he's coming home or what the deal is. And boy, it makes you cranky and angry and skinny, and you smoke a lot, and you become irritable. And those poor girls at the grocery store, oh my gosh, they were getting it all the time because I couldn't control what he was doing. But boy, if they weren't fast enough or somebody had too many items in their line or whatever, I mean, I had meltdowns all the time at the grocery store. And I try and practice differently today. Sometimes I get away with it and sometimes I don't. But what happened was, it wasn't a Friday night any different than any of the other Friday nights that I had, but I had just decided I just couldn't sit through another Friday night. So I packed a few things and threw them in a clothes basket and went to my mom and dad's house. And my mom and dad were never home on Friday night. They were always out with their friends or whatever, but God thing, they happened to be home, and it was like they were waiting for me. And I came in, and I just started talking about, you know, things were really bad, and I didn't know what it was, and he wasn't coming home, and I think it was because he didn't love me anymore. That, obviously what it could be, you know, that's the only thing, that he didn't love me anymore. And one of them said, do you think it could be his drinking? And I said, I don't know. I mean, I didn't put the two things together. I did not put any of the crazy things that I was thinking and doing. And a couple of the crazy things that I would do was we play the silent game. And I would give him the cold shoulder when he'd come in, and he could take it. And then it was a great excuse for him to leave, so then he'd leave, and then I'd have to go track him down. And then he would pretend that he wasn't there. And then I'd have to drive by, and, you know, a couple times I hollered things out the window, and, you know. That's who I was. So anyway, my parents asked me if they thought it was his drinking, and I said I didn't know. And the next day they called my uncle, who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my aunt attended Al-Anon. And they took me over there, and they 12-stepped me, and they told me about alcoholism, and that I can't cure it, I can't control it, and I didn't cause it, and that I needed help. I didn't need any help, did I? If he would straighten up and come home, everything would be okay. I think, you know, if one alcoholic affects 10 people, we should have, you know, I mean, all these seats should be filled. But there's something about when you are the affected family member, I could not see my part in anything. It was all about him. If I went to the video store and went to get a movie for myself, I couldn't pick out anything for myself. I could tell you what he wanted to watch. I would stand there for an hour and not be able to pick out anything for myself. So my aunt and uncle suggested that if I wanted to make this marriage work, that we might want to go to treatment. So I was hoping that what I said to him was, it's treatment or divorce. And I was so hoping the divorce. It's like, oh, you know, I'd be done, I'd look good, you know, I'd give him a choice and he'd pick that one. And then I, you know, divorce is okay. I had planned being a widow, too, before. I had my outfit all picked out, who would be the pallbearers. Widow just sounded a lot more honorable than divorced. And, you know, he had this big motorcycle, and I just planned him crashing it, not running into anybody else. I just wanted him to kill himself. You know, don't run into a car full of people, or, you know, just kill yourself. And there's something with when you live with somebody, and you are so angry and you feel like you hate them, but you're so relieved when you hear their car or their vehicle pull in the driveway. So it's the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. And so, you know, here I am, love, hate, love, hate. So I said, treatment or divorce, and he picked treatment. So I made an appointment for the treatment center. We went, and I remember her first name, Dorothy, and they asked him the questions, and I answered because I knew he wouldn't be truthful. And she said, we have a place for you. I'm just trying to be helpful. I didn't know what she meant. There was nothing wrong with me. I'm vacuuming my rugs out of the room and then walking on the furniture to keep it nice and pristine, but there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not eating, you know. I would go to work and stay all day, but I would run red lights getting home because I was not in the car. I was always wondering what he was doing and who he was doing it with and when he was going to come home. So there wasn't anything wrong with me. So they put me in treatment for 2 weeks. And I didn't know what they wanted. You know, they'd ask me how I was. Fine. You know, I didn't understand what they wanted. So what I was thinking about was 19 years ago, I was in a room like this at my first Cornhusker Roundup. And they told him that they would let their little group go to the early from outpatient treatment, so they'd go to the Cornhusker Roundup. And I thought, what's a rodeo going to do? I've been to a rodeo with him. He drinks through the whole rodeo, but maybe they had a clue. There's got to be, you know, maybe I miss something. So I had just moved back into the house, and so I had a little bit of the upper hand, and he wasn't going to go, and I said, I think we're going to go. So we went and we registered, and I saw three people that kind of hung out together in his little group. They seemed really fun, two guys and a girl, and I picked them out for him to be his little recovery buddies. And he wasn't having any of that, because I said, oh, those are three people, and he said, I'm not sitting by them. So we sat by ourselves way in the back. And I remember they opened it, and the speaker talked. And I'm sure what I did was I gave him a couple elbows, probably, and hoping that he's really paying attention to these certain things. But the thing that got me was everybody stood up, and they held hands. And you know that hum that goes through you when, you know, 1,000 people are saying the same thing? They said the Lord's Prayer, and boy, I wanted what was in that room. The only problem is I wanted it for him. I didn't want it for me. I didn't know that I could have that. I just thought that this was just for other people. So I'd gone to a couple Al-Anon meetings, and the only reason I went was because my counselor told me I wasn't going to make it. So I, you know, kind of spiteful and just a little bit oppositional. And she says, you're not going to make it. And I didn't know what she meant, make it in what? You know, I'm going to get an A in Al-Anon or what? How many meetings do you have to go to? They didn't suggest six. Because I would have figured, they didn't talk about the steps either. I thought, two steps a week. They didn't talk about steps. I went to a meeting, and I picked a meeting that had an AA and Al-Anon meeting at the same time. So when he got out of treatment, we'd go together. I knew that was important. We both needed to go to these meetings, and I didn't know why. And so the first couple times, I was too scared to go by myself. And so my mom went with me. She kind of weaned me after that. She's like, I can't go tonight. Maybe you can go by yourself. And you know, the miracle is I did not feel like I was home when I walked through the doors of Al-Anon. I didn't feel that there was any solutions there for me. But I did feel that maybe I could contribute something to these poor people. So I just kind of kept coming. And, you know, nobody, I went to one meeting a week, and I know today is probably not the healthiest meeting in Omaha. We had the same chairperson for 3 years, and I don't think it's in the book anymore. But anyway, I went, and when he got done with treatment, he says, you know, I don't think I need to go. And I knew what happened when you don't go to meetings. I mean, I've been going to Al-Anon long enough to know that if you don't go to meetings, you know, you're going to drink, and I can't go back to living that way. But the miracle is I continued to go to Al-Anon. And what Al-Anon taught me was just those basic things, like I said, eat when you're hungry, sleep when you're tired, and keep your mouth shut. So I did that. And every week I would go and report something wonderful that I did that week. Like, he told me not to get my hair cut, and I did it anyway. And they were like, we are so glad you're here. So I just kept coming back until the light went on. And I think for me, what happened was I'd been going to Al-Anon for a year. And I knew it was just a matter of time before he drank again. And it was a Friday night. Gosh, those Friday nights, they were bad. And it was a Friday night, and he came home, and I'd give him that kiss sniff, you know, so you can get it just a whiff, because I knew it was coming, and I smelled alcohol. And it was like somebody had taken a bat to my gut, and I thought, you know, I can't live like this anymore. But I remembered something in our literature that says, changed attitudes can aid recovery. I'll change my attitude, we'll all recover, I can do this. I see people all the time live with active alcoholism, I can do it. And so I did, for a while. What happened was, in my infinite wisdom of one meeting a week, and I didn't have a sponsor because I didn't hear him talk about him, I wasn't working the steps, we need a baby. You know, this is going to fix everything. I always wanted one, and I didn't want to be alone in my old age. So I thought, you know, we'll have a baby. And so we had a little girl. And then a couple years later, we had another little girl. And I heard that it's abstinence, insanity, or death. And I had always hoped for death for him. And I thought, what am I going to do when he's insane? You know, I mean, what am I going to do? I've got these little kids. You know, how am I going to deal with this? And One night at my Tuesday night meeting, this woman came in, and she was the first person that had what I wanted. And I was willing to do anything. And then I went to a meeting because I knew I needed to get well for my kids. I didn't know so much that I needed to get well for me, but I knew I needed to get well for my kids and that this is not what is good, you know. I needed to get well, and I needed to get well fast. And so she was at another meeting, and we were talking about fear, and she was talking about being found out and all that crazy thinking and the green hair and the, oh, you know, was just had been churning inside of me. And I started following her around like a bad smell. Everywhere she went, I was there. We went to a lot of meetings during the day. They all had babysitting. My kids were like 1 and 3 or 2 and 4, something like that. And boy, I went to a meeting probably 3 or 4 times a week. And, you know, what happens in Al-Anon, one of the things that scared me was, boy, you get in Al-Anon, you get a divorce. And that doesn't always happen. But for me, what happened was there were some things going on in my home that I had a low bottom. And there were things going on that I finally just said, you know, in a very calm way. And when I started talking to my sponsor, I asked this woman to be my sponsor. And when I started letting her in and sharing those things that I was thinking and feeling, and it's just like I just felt so free. I felt like somebody understood me. And I was always afraid that if I told somebody all these crazy thoughts that were going in my head, that they would never talk to me again. And she just kept loving me. The more I shared with her, the more she loved me. Well, it became apparent to me through a lot of prayer and meditation because, boy, if I heard stay in the moment and pray about it for the first, I don't know, several years that I had her as a sponsor, I prayed about this marriage, and it became very apparent to me that it was time to leave that marriage. And so my kids were 3 and 5, and we got a divorce. Life got really fun. I was single in recovery, and I was going to a lot of things, and one of the things that I loved most about Al-Anon here was the fellowship. There was always something to do. People always had ideas, and I think my home group is Sunday Night Benson, and I think one of the reasons I love it so much is because it is so much fun, and there's always something to do. And I went to an open meeting with a friend, because she didn't want to go by herself, and her boyfriend was speaking there, and so I went and I met John, and wouldn't give my number right away. I waited 2 weeks, and then he deliberately didn't call me right away, you know, the dance, because, so he called me, and then we started dating, and, you know, so it's like, we're both in recovery for like 10 years, and this part gets really crazy. He gets a promotion to Milwaukee, and I'm not going anywhere. This is it, you know, they might have Al-Anon there, but it's going to stink. And I'm not leaving. And my sponsor just kept saying, you just need to pray about it. You just need to pray about it. And, you know, I thought about, okay, you know, God, you show me what to do. And everything just started falling into place. I had to get permission to get the kids out of Omaha, and things just started happening. And the people in Al-Anon and my family loved me enough to let me go. And they gave me a going away party. Of course, I was too sick to go, so they had it anyway and gave me pictures and a bunch of notes that I still have today. And so it was like December 22nd, we went to court to get the kids out of the state. We had Christmas on December 25th. We packed the house up on December 26th. We got married on the 28th. We left on the 29th. Boy, it was crazy. You know, if somebody I sponsor wanted to do that, I'd be saying, you know, I think maybe you need to take a look at this. But, you know, it was just a God thing. This is what we were supposed to be doing. And my parents brought the kids up January 2nd, and they left, and we were just, oh, my God, you know, I'm not in Omaha anymore. I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I went to a meeting that very night. I am from Al-Anon community here that is very active. And I've never had the luxury to decide whether or not I should go to meetings because I get crazy on the meetings I go to now. So I don't have the luxury of maybe I'll go to a meeting and maybe I won't. So I started attending Al-Anon right away, and boy, they didn't do it right, and they weren't fun at all. And of course, I wasn't smart enough not to tell them that. And, you know, every time I would go in there and I'd say, this is not how they don't do this like this in Omaha, and they'd say, we are so glad you're here. You know, would you come back and see us? Well, of course. You know, I was going to help them make it be like Omaha. And, you know, the funny thing is, I had an opportunity to bring some people back here, and we always were here for the Sunday night meeting. And there's a Sunday night meeting in Milwaukee. I couldn't do it by myself. And so there's a Sunday night meeting in Milwaukee, and they have raffle night, and they try real hard to be fun. And they do a really good job. But, you know, it became my home in spite of it. I mean, I always cry when I leave here. Omaha, I always cried when I left. But once I got back there, you know, I made some really good friends, and they had fellowship, and, you know, the Al-Anon meetings were really good. And then John got a promotion to Cincinnati. And I knew I could do it because I'd done it before and I was prepared. You know, I'm not going to tell them how they don't do it right. Sit there. This. I would share. And they were like, we are so glad you're here. We keep coming back. And, you know, it's like the body language. You know, I'm just not going to share with them what I know. And they would tease me about it after a while, you know, about where I came from. And it would be like, well, we know we're not as good, but, you know, we're trying. One of the things that really saved me was, it wasn't, you know, the Al-Anon was good, but it wasn't like anything that I had. And Bob was talking about dying inside, and that's what started to happen to me in Cincinnati. I was just dying inside. And I was praying about it, and I was at the Buckeye Roundup they have there in November. And this friend of mine who I knew, Beth Hartley, said, we're starting a Foxhole meeting on Monday night. Would you come? So John and I started to go, and that's where the fun and the laughter, and there weren't that many people. I mean, certainly not like Foxhall here, but it was fun, and it just, you know, it just fit that need. And of course, you know, it was a very small meeting, and I guess they just had their 2-year anniversary, and I was kind of the token Al-Anon. And I really liked being there because they would talk about service positions, and I didn't have to feel guilty about not taking them because they wouldn't let me participate anyway. So I would just kind of sit there and pass my money. And what was funny was one time they were changing positions and John wanted to be the cake lady and they wouldn't give it to him because they knew I'd be the cake lady. They said, no, you got to be something else. You got to do something else. So, we're in Cincinnati. And it's okay. It was never my home. Milwaukee became my home, but Cincinnati was never my home. And I think it was about a year ago, something like that. I went through, like, the most painful time that I've ever been through. And it was one of those things that kind of helped me relate to the newcomers because I would have to remind myself to breathe. You know, I'd be sitting, like, in a chair, and I would be holding my breath. And I remembered what I heard when I was a newcomer. You know, breathe, eat, you know, sleep, take care of the things that you need to take care of. And I was so glad that I had the Al-Anon community there because when this thing happened, I mean, they just rallied around me. You know how you go to meetings every week and you just feel like, you know, you're there and nobody really notices you. But I'll tell you, when this thing happened, people came out of the woodwork for me. And, of course, I always had my sponsor here and I called her. And I mean, there were people praying all over the United States and I could feel it as painful as it was. It's like Bob was talking about how, or somebody was talking about how life goes on. You know, life does go on. When you're in Al-Anon, AA, whatever, life happens and painful things happen. And what happened was there's a woman that went to my home group. And for a couple years I was there, and every time it'd be step 10 and 11, she'd talk about how she'd get up every morning and write her written 10 step, and how she'd get up half hour early and be quiet and meditate. And I don't need to do that. You know, 5 minutes is plenty for me. But I wanted what she had. And so a couple years ago, I started getting up and doing that stuff. And I'll tell you, when this thing hit last year, I knew what to do. You know, I knew how to get quiet. I knew how to get that feeling of, in the midst of chaos, there was a peace. And I was told, in a way that I could understand, by the God of my understanding, that I was going to be okay. No matter what happened with the situation, no matter what, I was going to be okay. And I am. The funny thing was, I was speaking with Rick in January, and I told him, I'm moving back to Omaha. I said, God's probably up there laughing at me, but I'm moving back to Omaha. And he saw the flyer, and he goes, my God, she did it. So I prayed about it. We decided it was time to move back to Omaha. The girls were going to be in 7th and 9th grade. If we were going to do it, now's the time to do it. So John came back and stayed at his brother's house and looked for a job, and I stayed behind and took care of the kids and did the dance recitals in school, and our house sold in like 3 weeks. He came here and got a job in 2 months. And so I always thought, I spent a lot of days, and you know, this is my own fault. I knew what I needed to do to reach out. But, you know, there were some days when, you know, John would be in Omaha or whatever, and, you know, I'd be with these kids, and I'd be like, you know, what am I going to do? Because I always looked outside of myself for entertainment. That's why you hang out with alcoholics. They're entertainment. And I thought, you know, I've been hanging out with enough alcoholics. I should have absorbed some of that. So it was up to me to make my own entertainment, you know, and I did okay. I'm so grateful for Al-Anon. You know, everybody, all the speakers have talked about acting differently than how you feel. You know, you can't act your way into right thinking or whatever it is. You've heard it several times this weekend. And Al-Anon taught me how to act. And after this thing happened, my daughter was having her 14th birthday. And the last thing I wanted to do was throw this kid a party. You know, I mean, I was just in such pain. You know, but people told me she needs a party. And so we had the party. You know, I mean, I'm so grateful for that, that the world did not come to a screeching halt because I'm feeling bad. You know, we had the party, and it was a fun party, and I look at the pictures now, and she was having a great time, and I'm so glad that I went against what I felt, and that I went and just did what the next best thing. Al-Anon just says, do the next best thing. Sometimes it isn't this big thing like moving. Sometimes it's clean your bathroom. Sometimes it's mealtime, fix a meal. Sometimes it's time for you to be quiet. So we moved back here. John bought a house and then showed me the videotape of it. People were saying, how do you do that? And it's like, it's not important for me where I live here. I'm just grateful to be here. I don't care where I live. So we moved in, and so what I'm like today, I still struggle with those darn cashiers at Baker's or wherever I am. I just do. I always just think, you know, we talk about being, I am self-centered. I mean, it's all about me. Don't they know who I am? Can't they open another line? Rick was talking today about, why do I want to control and manipulate things? Because it's easier for me. If I can have things my way, it is easier for me. And I've learned to kind of let go of that. And I think another gift that Al-Anon has given me is to allow my kids to be where they are. When we moved back 2 months ago, I moved home. My kids didn't move home. You know, they moved back to their dad and to my parents and their other grandparents and their aunts and uncles, but they didn't move home. And it's been real hard to watch my oldest especially struggle with not having friends and going to be in ninth grade. You know, all they can do is hug her. That's what you taught me to do. You know, you don't try and suck their pain from them. You just let them know that you're there. And just to hug them. You know, I hope that I can be as good at unconditional love as my parents were. I'm not just saying that because you're here. I usually say that. You know, all the choices that I made, you know, to marry my first husband, they said, what can we do to help? And that's what Al-Anon does for me. You know, whatever your decision is, I've had support in it. And that's what I need, because I've done some hard things that at the time didn't seem like really big important things, moving 500 miles, but you know, I just kind of went ahead and flew by the seat of my pants, and because I knew that God went ahead in love and prepared people for me and places for me. So today we're getting ready for school on Monday, and we went to orientation for my youngest, and they didn't have her schedule. And the funny thing about my kids, you know, in Al-Anon they tell you you're not that big of a deal, but boy, your kids watch you. And what happens is, when things don't go right, they both go. So we walked in, and where's Caitlin's schedule? We don't have it. And I'm like, okay, what would a sane, rational person do? You know, they wouldn't, she needs to be taken. Okay, I went like this, and she did way better with it than I did. She said, okay. They said, we'll have it here on Monday. I was going to march down to the principal's office. But I stopped for that minute and thought, do I want to embarrass them here? How do I want to act? What kind of person do I want to be? You know, what am I going to put out there? And before, I just reacted to everybody and everything. The job that I've had coming into recovery, our living amends to those poor people I worked with at Commercial Federal during those drinking years, if any of you are here, I apologize. The neat thing is now we decided that since the kids weren't going to have any friends for the summer that I would stay home and, you know, make myself available. And it's been really fun, you know, trying to keep two teenagers busy. And the neatest thing, you know, someone else touched on this. I could have just got up here and said what Rick said, what Eileen said, what Bob said, is I've gotten to be of service to people since I've moved back here, because I don't have a job yet. My kids are older. You know, I've gotten to take my great aunt to her hair appointments at the grocery store. That is a thing for patients. You know what my mom and I talk about taking her to the grocery store, and I just take the list and the coupons, and I say, do you want this or this? Do you want this or this? You know, just make it easy for myself and easy for her. But I've been able to be of service to people. I've gotten to babysit my nieces and nephews, and I get to go to one of the most wonderful meetings in the whole world. I guess what I would like to close with is when I walked through these doors, I had no friends. All I knew how to do was peek out windows and plan funerals. And also, I was somewhat of a hypochondriac. I had a symptoms and illness book that Carol begged and begged and begged me to get rid of. I've lived through so much. Nothing's ever happened to me, but I have lived through so much. I've had several different cancers and whatever, but I seem to always come through with flying colors. I have a life today. I have friends today. I have choices today. I try not to live through other people. I have a marriage today. So I'd like to close with this meditation that I use. I hope I can remember it. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors as he worketh steadily. Oft times in sorrow and sometimes foolish pride, I forget he sees the top while I the underside. Not till the moon is silent and the settles cease to fly, does God unroll the canvas and explain the reasons why. But the dark threads are as needful in a skillful weaver's hand as the threads of gold and silver and the pattern that God has planned. Thank you all for being here.